But the whole thing was futile because they were setting ducks for even gunneries in the ground. They were good gunners, and they were setting ducks for fighters.
So you yourself determined that ducks were not the way to go and went to the
They may have had a purpose at that time, but even whatever they were clumsy. In a storm, what are you going to do with this great, with air power? You could fight, or you could run, you could evade. But these things couldn't evade. They were again sitting ducks for either for storms or enemy aircraft, or enemy fighting power. I don't care whether it's a good ground gunnery or other aircraft. We could evade them, attack them when we like. Withdraw and fight again, they couldn't.
Okay. Point taken then, sir, if I'm correct, that though the government was showing some interest
in an empire sense, and I think they were right.
And they were right, but the money wasn't coming in 2080, or?
No. We weren't getting any money.
You weren't getting any money in 2080.
We were still using. Largely, not all entirely. We got a few aircraft,
mm-hmm.
but we were still using those old war gift things, the money gift that the
from Britain. Yeah.
And you just turn that off a second. Something I want to.
We're back on, sir. Something about Mackenzie King.
Yes. Well, the 30th of June of 1920 in the House of Commons in Ottawa, Mr. Mackenzie King immediately protested against the action of the government in putting large sums in the supplementary rather than in the main estimate. It was not treating Parliament or the country fairly to put an item of $250,000 for the air service, this was our total, what we had, in the main estimate, and then in the last two or three days of the session bring down the supplementary of more money. To this criticism, Mr. Guthrie replied that the Air Board could not be blamed as it was not known until the first week of May when the gift aircraft and equipment were shipped to Canada. Then Mr. Mackenzie King went on, later on, Mr. King charged that the British government, by presenting it, the gift, or presenting it to the Dominion to reduce the cost of maintenance, that's why they were giving it away, was simply, just as they say, getting rid of surplus war material. And very unkind. I think that he still felt the same way about the Air Force in 1937-38, when he rebuffed and rebuked Captain Jim Robb, when he came out to Canada to persuade us to consider the uses of, and the great value of the world of the British Commonwealth Air Training Plan, and he, that's when Mackenzie King, in a private conversation, not this wasn't in the House of Commons, said, well, Robb, you better wait to see which side Canada wants to fight on. Rob was absolutely shaken when he came over to our headquarters and told us what went on. He became Air Chief Marshal, Sir James Robb, in War II.
Well, this is the thing with Mackenzie King, had strings of cash. He was always afraid there was some strings of cash coming from.
Anything from Britain.
Britain.
Well, of course, his grandfather had to go off to the island.
Grandfather and something else. But I guess the thing is that did you talk about this type of thing?
The troops did, yes, among themselves.
Amongst yourselves in the, well, not troops, I think, but the officers in the mess. Political units at this time?
Political units, that's a better word, but we still had our likes and dislikes as the leadership that we got.
Henry King was no friend of the Air Force, is that right?
I don't think he was much of a friend of any of the troops.
Understandable.
We had to call on him when he was Prime Minister, though. We had to call on him if he lived in Ottawa once or twice a year. You always gave us a drink of tea at Christmas.
A nice tea, did you?
Well, I don't know.
Did you have the picture of the dog on the mantle?
Well, chiefly his mother. I did admire his painting of his mother. She was a beautiful lady.
Sir, I'm just about out of tape on this side. Let me just slip over the tape and not anything you want.
My name is Chris Maiden. I'm continuing on with an interview with Air Vice Marshal G.R. Housen. The date today is 27 August 1979, and we're at Air Vice Marshal Housen's home in Victoria. Before I turn the tape over, sir, we were talking about this period in 28 when you were at the college.
Yes.
In Canada. And did you not feel sort of... awkward in the sense that you were a military force, you're the Royal Canadian Air Force, you were at a staff college discussing military affairs, strategy, tactics, and yet the entire flying up to this point, other than a little bit of training at Borden, had been a civilian. You know what I'm getting at, sir?
I think I do. Strangely, no. There was no question of awkwardness in the flying, nor in any sense or any idea of being awkward. Flying was flying, and if you couldn't fly, if you could fly one, you could probably fly the other. And it's only a matter of simple adaptation from one aircraft to the other. And many of them were made with the idea of there being of dual mm-hmm. purpose.
Yeah.
So there was no great problem there.
I'm thinking of gunnery, tactics.
Well, that had been our first... We'd cut our teeth on that in the flying corps in the beginning. So
you had, but I'm thinking of the others.
Coming in? Well, we saw to it that they made their teeth work that way, too. That was their job. There was never any question that wasn't the set of the job. We didn't want them around.
So you didn't feel awkward, particularly, in the sense of...
Being out of our depth, no. We were, by study and by work, we intended to be competent in whatever fields that we had to contend with.
Okay, fair enough. You mentioned Trenchard, of course, and doing concerning air power. There was an Italian.
Yes, he flew.
Was his name Douay, or?
No.
Was it an Italian or French?
There was an Italian. He flew around the world, and he flew into, he came down to Shediac, put his boats into Shediac, and then went down to the United States. But he was the first to fly flying boats from east to west. But the British...
No, I'm thinking of I'm sorry, sir, I'm thinking of someone else. I'm not thinking of the fascist flight, but I'm thinking more, rather of, there was a great, one of the few people that actually wrote a book on air power and the whole concept of air power.
I think it is. And he's the same man. And he was killed. If he's the man that I think that you were referring to.
I think his name is Douay. I'm not sure.
Not quite. No? Not quite right. But anyway, do you recall Mussolini's battle? He was sent by Mussolini. He became too popular. But that is about the time that he became popular, in the mid-20s.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the one who flew through Canada, and he became much too popular in Italy. And Lucy, did they call him? Lucy, he was the Mussolini.
Mussolini was Duce, yeah.
Whatever, mm-hmm. However you pronounce it. And... He sent the guy off to in charge of one of the Italian satellites in North Africa. He got him out of Italy. Well, then along Mussolini's war with
Ethiopia,
he was killed about that time.
I'm just wondering if you studied his works at the same time, or was it
purely
French or British? That's what I'm getting at.
We weren't missing anything that he had worthwhile, but
okay.
Trenchard was so far ahead of him and so far advanced in thinking. See, Mitchell had been on General Mitchell of the United States had been very close to Trenchard in 1918, and when Trenchard was the head of the Independent Air Force.
Yes.
And he, so that's where he got the idea of sinking battleships.
So you're all coming out of the same school, then, in that sense of the country.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
The United, Mitchell was definitely part of, well, he was one of the most foremost persons in the world in thinking about air power at that time.
Okay.
But he was much younger than Trenchard,
mm-hmm.
and definitely a pupil of Trenchard's thinking.
Fair
same
enough.
As the rest of us.
Now, you remain at this college, and it's a staff college.
Well, it was a staff college course.
Staff college course,
yes.
In Kingston, I think.
Yes. Staff college preparatory course.
Staff college preparatory at Kingston.
Yes.
Not the actual staff college itself.
No. Oh, no.
You're not taking your staff college training there. You will then, in turn, go to the RAS.
Well, you're taking
staff college.
You're being prepared for it. It is an elementary school, if you like.
Okay.
Preparing you to go on to something else.
Okay.
That's the idea of Trenchard or Dick Dewing setting up the committees and the teams.
The syndicates and
syndicates.
Things, yes.
The staff guys worked on that later on. So going from there, you'd already had a pretty good elementary introduction to what you're going to get when you hit the staff guys. It's very, very useful. Very useful.
Now, you attend staff college in RAF staff college?
In Andover.
In Andover, England?
Yes.
What time, sir? Dates?
Well, I left here in the autumn of 1929, late autumn. And
okay, well, before we get you there, then, and that'll be question number 6 from Dr. Douglas, I'm thinking of, should I put this... You mentioned you were down at Cleveland watching some air races, and what did you do between your Kingston tour and before you went to staff college?
When I left Winnipeg, I went to Camp Borden as the camp adjutant.
Mm-hmm.
And at the camp at that time, we had not only the Air Force there, but we had the beginning of the Signal Corps. They had a Signal Corps, but it was commanded by a major, and our colonel, or our group captain, it was Coyle, G.M. Coyle, and I, as camp adjutant, they funneled it to our office.
Now, had you been promoted at this point to
still
squadron leader?
No, still flight lieutenant.
You were still flight lieutenant. Yeah. Then you mentioned you went down to the States for
well,
an air race.
Well, what happened then, by that time, we were taking our aircraft at certain times of the year, especially at the Toronto National Exhibition in Canada, or to Hamilton, to London.
Barnstorming type thing?
Not exactly barnstorming. More of a demonstration of what, let the people see what could be done. And we were doing this on Siskins.
So it'd be sort of like a public relations type, like the snowbirds today, sir? Or?
Well, this is the first thing of that idea in Canada. We called in the Siskin team.
Mm-hmm.
And Canada did very well. I happened to be the senior one in the Siskins.
Oh, so you were actually in this team?
I led the team.
You led the team?
Well, I was senior one.
Well, you're holding out on me. You didn't tell me that.
Well, if you want to see it, I'll show you. We won 2 gifts. We got a good, handsome suitcase. I got mine upstairs still. It's still fairly serviceable. And for teamwork, and then you did individual work. And what we were able to do, the Americans were not able to do with any of their aircraft, we had a radial engine. In the
mm-hmm.
Siskin had a powerful radial engine. Now, the radial engine was not the rotary that I told you about the last time with the
mm-hmm.
centrifugal action. We had the ordinary propeller torque, as you do with any aircraft. But the radial had the lighter power, tremendous power, but a much lighter engine than you would have the stationary engine that had the fluid cooling. And we could fly inverted. And that's the first, by that time, we taught ourselves to fly upside down as well. And you could spend, in every minute, you could spend about 40 seconds upside down, and the other 20 seconds you wanted, but you didn't have to time it exactly that way, but you needed a certain amount of time with your aircraft right side up to have the engine clear itself.
Because if you stayed there too long, your engine would gum up and you would lose power. So by doing about two-thirds of your time, but you had to make it pretty quick. You didn't dare go any length of time. So we did much of our work inverted, and the crowd did never see anything like it. So we took their hats off a bit.
Now, this would be based out of Borden?
We were based at Borden, yes.
And this would be, what, the early part of 1929?
Well, we started off in about the early in August. We went to straight from Borden to Hamilton. They had an air show there and put on an air show in Hamilton.
This would be, what, 28 or 29?
29, yes.
Now, and then...
So we went first to Hamilton.
Mm-hmm.
We went from Hamilton to Kitchener and London, and then from there to Cleveland, and put on the Cleveland Air Races, the Cleveland Air Show,
mm-hmm.
and Lindbergh, of course, crossed the Atlantic by that time, and he came in with an escort. But the air show there was very good. Now, that wasn't the first one. There'd been one earlier than that in Buffalo. And then there's another one followed up near. There's a good bit of intermingling between Canada and the United States at that time, and especially in Air Force. And we were very happy about it because we met some of the very finest people, and we got to know them.
Mm-hmm.
And it was tremendously useful there and all through World War II because we were able to work together much better than we ever would have been able to work if this had not taken place. It is invaluable. To me, and to a lot of worked out with a lot of people.
Now the Siskin team, which you were ahead of,
very small. There were only about four or five of us all together.
And you'd be flying what? Yes. Aerobatics.
Yes. Well,
formation.
We did everything in formation,
mm-hmm.
Except individual. You could have individual aerobatics, you know, if you wanted. We did have that too. I got two prizes. I told you, I got the. The team got a bag, a
mm-hmm.
good traveling bag. But for individual aerobatics, I pulled that off of myself, and I got a belt, a handsome belt, with an American dollar set right into
the
buckle of the belt, and I still have it upstairs now.
Wow.
I think you'll find that the dollar was minted before 1929.
Is that right?
Had to be.
Huh? Isn't that incredible?
I'll show it to you.
My God. So you flew with this team, and I gather this occupied your time before you went to staff college, is that correct?
Oh, not very much. You did your practice in your own time. You had your own work to do.
So it wasn't like a formalized team like the Snowbirds today that would do everything?
That took place about 2 years later. 2 years later, they set up the Siskin team. But at that time, we were just, Vic Beamish is an officer on exchange from England, and he'd flown them in England, so
mm-hmm.
Harding was the other one, Canadian, but he could never fly upside down. He couldn't, he did, at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But it was more public relations demonstration.
Demonstration team. Now, you remained at Borden, is that correct, until you went to Staff College?
Yes, I left there and went to Staff College.
Now, there were problems with quarters and things at Borden, is that correct?
Not very much. Not very,
no.
Very not, not at that time.
I was thinking of living quarters and things.
We had the old wartime buildings were there right up to World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a number of, and some of... There were a number of married quarters, yes, but their old buildings have been converted.
Now, had you been married at this point, or
yes,
by this point?
Yes, yes, yes. Sir.
And I'm thinking of facilities there. They had, they didn't have the canvas hangers. They had those iron hangers, didn't they, with iron frames?
Most of them, all of them started, the Besnor hangar started as canvas, and
yeah.
Then they were sheathed in with later years. Wooden walls, and they'd been strengthened because they used to collapse before. That was very uncomfortable to your machines, the aircraft. A big strong wind would strike them, and push them over.
Is that right?
Yeah, well, the weather and snow would collapse them too. So they were third distinction. Some of them were probably still there, as far as I know.
My God. You remain as, I guess, your actual title would be, what, 2IC?
I was camp adjutant.
Your duties as camp adjutant in 29 at Borden?
At first, I meant. By the time that the... mid 29, I moved down to the aerodrome by this time, and I had six pupils, elementary pupils, as well as doing this other work. I wore two or three hats because you had to.
Just had to with the manpower at the time.
Well, yes, you took on your extra jobs, and that was it.
Well, Air Marshal Dunlop was there from 28, 29. Do you recall him at all? He wasn't an air marshal then, but...
Well, he was one of our brightest young boys.
He was?
Oh, yes, and Roy Slemon and Larry Dunlop. He's here now, living here.
Yes.
They were two of our sterling chaps, and they did extraordinarily well. But we had some grand boys, young men go through there. A1 plus, including, I've mentioned two, Slemon and...
Mm-hmm.
But there are 100 more that are good,
mm-hmm.
excellent. 100, 200, 300, whatever you like.
The Air Force has always been known for getting the cream, if you will, of the people, of recruits, and this is true then, do you believe?
I think that we sieved them pretty carefully.
They were screened very well. Okay, tremendous.
We tried to. Let's put that, we tried hard.
Okay. Now, I'm thinking of page... The next page, question 6 from Dr. Douglas's questionnaire. Did you attend an RAF staff college or the Imperial Defense College between 1919 and 39? And if so, when? And what was its nature? And who taught it? And did the instructors emphasize a particular strategic viewpoint? And how did the course benefit you upon your return to Canada?
That's
a real mouthful.
Well, I'll try and break it down into A, B, C, and D, because if I don't, the answer that I started off for, yes, I did attend the Royal Air Force Staff College at Andover. It's called, Andover is number 8 course, the 8th course that the Royal Air Force had put on at the... Its nature was top shelf to me.
And this is 1929, is
that correct? The end of 29. Actually, the course really got going in the beginning of 30. The introduction in December, and then we broke for the Christmas break. To me, it was, as I said, the top shelf, the big league. And the best teachers in the directing staff were Wing Commander Tedder. He became Lord Tedder. He was one of our chief ones.
He was a marshal of the RAF, was he not?
He became Air Chief Marshal Lord Tedder. He was then Wing Commander Tedder. He was the chief of staff to Eisenhower, as I said. Now, then another one was Wing Commander Roderick Hill, and he became the Air Officer in Chief in the defense of Great Britain in War II. The third one, now the others were not quite so senior, as Wing Commander James Robb, that I told you came out to Canada in 1937,
mm-hmm.
but he was there, and he'd been one of, at this time, Robb and McKay and Tedder had become part of Trenchard's selected team in the field, and they'd all be drawn in from time to time to London, drawn into London to function as Trenchard's team. Trenchard was the brain and the plan, the great.
But he brought in all the whiz kids too, though.
Well, he had his selected team.
Group of
The way they never used.
You didn't call them whiz kids.
No, but they were part of the team that sought out the idea that the
mm-hmm.
training. They'd had a great deal of trouble with training, any kind of training in the British Isles during war, in War I. Mm-hmm. That's why they put it out, part of the, why they put out the elementary training, your first training, into Canada. And then the part of it went to Mexico, to Texas, as you know. That is why they done it in the First War. Now, they realized then, with the advance of air power, Trenchard did very clearly, that you couldn't have any kind of training in the battle zone and get it. Now, the Germans never caught on to that. And they still were mucking around in the mud in World War II. So if they'd had a staff guard, as I say, mm-hmm. or if they'd had the brains.
Did you know that in 1930?
They did, and they were trying. They were putting it into our heads.
This is what I'm getting at, though, is that they were telling you then that it had to be out of the war zone.
Yes, but we didn't admit that we wanted it in Canada. First of all, none of us were sure that we wanted to be school teachers, in that sense.
That was your criteria,
Well, in a war and be school teachers?
Yeah, but you're supposed to think of the greater scheme, the team.
Never mind, I understand that. In the end, we were convinced. Coming down to Rob, he came out to Canada, as I told you.
Mm-hmm.
Do
you want to jump ahead to Rob?
I think I better clean up this. Do one thing at one time.
Okay, sir.
Yes. I told you, it was very good. The strategic point, he mentioned, well, what about the strategic point? What was the question again? If so, when was what was its nature and who taught it? Did the instructors emphasize a particular strategic viewpoint? How did the course benefit you upon your return to Canada? Those are the questions. Fair enough?
Yes, sir.
Now, coming to the strategic viewpoint, yes, the proper use of air power. The proper use of sea power, the proper use of land forces, and the great value of teamwork and timing. For example, in timing, Nelson at Copenhagen. There was no teamwork there, if you'll remember. Mm-hmm. But Nelson certainly knew his timing. Now, I'll give you another one. Allenby in Mesopotamia that I gave you a little while ago. That was the strategic part. Now, the next thing that probably after was the vital importance of a strong civil base. You can't fight any kind of war without a strong civil base for your supplies, your public, a strong, secure public behind you.
It would be almost like the Royal Navy bases, the same
strategy. Well, but I'm thinking this is your civil base. You've got to have a strong civil base, a national industry. And you've got to see to it that you've got those things.
Yeah, but how can you see to that as an officer?
That's your job. Work toward it.
But what authority is an officer in a force? Can
create your own force. You create your own job and stake out your own ground and work on it. But without it, don't go to war. Without it, don't go to war. How could we possibly have gone to war any other way? And furthermore, you'll get more of it as we go along.
Yeah, but sir, that's fine for military history. But what I'm getting at is how can you as an officer, who one, doesn't declare war on anybody, and number two, is cut off from the civilian base due to your occupation, how do you in turn ensure that these two are done so you can go to war?
If you listen to this, you'll find out how it did work out. Now, we mentioned the value of teamwork between sea power and the land forces and the timing and Nelson Copenhagen. Now, the vital importance of a strong civil base, a strong national industry. The United Kingdom could be, this is what we were taught at Staff College, and we agreed that the United Kingdom could be in the future war, 1930, could become the cockpit of the fighting. That's what it actually did during Battle of Britain. But therefore, all the primary training must be done in the Dominions. We agreed to that, but it's not our dominion. That is,
not our dominion, though.
Not at that time. And we were wrong in thinking that way, because we hadn't
the game
thought...
Was the primary concern being a school teacher as opposed to being in the action?
Yes.
Is that your prejudice, is what you're saying? Or were there other considerations?
That is the main one, that we wanted to be in the action, not as... be delegated to school teachers.
What other considerations or rationale would you use not to have the training plan in Canada as opposed to
somewhere
else?
Egypt. We thought it was a much better place, better climate. It could be then. Well, why not South Africa? Well, they Trenchard and his team had analyzed all these things, including Dewing and Mackey and a few of the others, good friends of mine and of ours, and they privately worked on us at every opportunity. We said, why not Egypt? Supposing that the enemy air power closes the Mediterranean to us, or practically closes it. It did happen in World War II, but they could see that far into the future. In the early 20s,
they needed their training scheme completely outside a possible theater of war. Is that what you got?
Your elementary training, all your first training, the only training that you could do in an advanced stage, could possibly have in your theater of war and do a good job, would be the advanced training, just the advanced training. But all the civil, all the elementary and all the intermediate training should be done free. Otherwise, you'd have constant interruption. And all your airline lines would be clogged with pupils struggling out of the way of bombers and fighters and running into collisions. The whole thing would be a catastrophe.
Now, these particular people, you were not the only Canadian, is that correct?
No, well, there were two of us.
And who were the other two, sir?
Do
you recall?
Yes, McEwen and myself. But there were several Canadian, former Canadians, who were permanent force officers and who had stayed in the IRA as I hadn't stayed.
Well, we're getting at, wait for the bell to go, we got one more here. Okay. What I'm getting at then, if what you say is correct, if I've understood what you said, is what I'm getting at. Rob, Tedder, Dewing used to sit down in spare moments and try and convert you to their belief. Is that correct?
Well,
on this particular item?
It could happen in both sessions, anyway. But we knew where they stood, and they knew where we stood. We were with them.